Well, the interesting thing about it is this phrase, from the brook by the wayside he will drink, therefore he will lift up his head. Now, scholars bow their heads and drop their heads over that. What is it doing in there? You have this great psalm, and then right at the end it talks about the king drinking from a brook. What does it have to do with the psalm? What meaning does it have? Well, there are two ways that this can be approached. One is to take the approach of Mowinkle, who says that that they went through this ritual annually, and that the king, the idea was that the king himself would give up his throne, renounce his throne, and then be given back to the throne as he succeeded to the power of Yahweh. But the king in the procession would go by the spring Gihon, and there he would drink of the holy water of the spring Gihon, and to symbolize the help that God would give him as he was a king, on his way in the procession to his throne when he would be restored to his throne again, and that this line has to do with the ritual drinking of the water from the spring in the holy procession. This is quite possible. On the other hand, these closing verses could indicate a later post-exilic addition to the original prophetic oracle that is influenced by the suffering servant concept of the book of Isaiah, where the servant has a difficult time achieving his purpose, and only after great discouragement and trouble is he finally elevated to the place of supremacy. And it could be that these verses show the influence of the second Isaiah and the influence of the suffering servant concept. And this is why God tells him to move over while he helps him win, because the suffering servant dies, is discouraged, is cut off, and only through the personal intervention of God is he given his place of power. It is likely, and I am disposed toward thinking, that these latter verses 5-7 are a post-exilic addition to the article of the earlier period of history of Israel. But now this is the original Zitzim Laban, though, regardless of how you view those latter verses. The original Zitzim Laban is applied to the actual king and God's promises to the Davidic king that as the successor of the position of Melchizedek, God himself will guarantee his support over all of his enemies forever. But something happened to that psalm. After the king no longer reigned on the throne, and after that they had even forgotten all of the ritual through which they went on these famous days, the psalm was still in the Psalter. And as the people read it, it no longer spoke to them about the king that was actually ruling on the throne. They had no king ruling on the throne. More and more, as they read that psalm, it spoke to them of the king to come. And the post-exilic community sang this psalm, and as they sang it, it spoke to them of the great Messiah king to come. And it gradually took on a context of the future. Until by the time you come into the New Testament, it is regarded as a messianic psalm and is commonly regarded so. And you get the New Testament context that we're so familiar with because this change occurred in the use of the psalm and its meaning to people as they sang it. This happened to many of the royal psalms. But when you sing it today as a Christian, or when it was sung in the 1600s, what sort of connotation does it have for you? In other words, when this psalm is sung today, does it speak to us of a king to whom a prophet has given an oracle during a cultic ritual in ancient Israel? Or does it speak as it would speak to a Jew living before the time of Christ? Does it speak only of the Messiah who is to come? Well, when a Christian sings this psalm, he sings it as a Christian, and this is why we have this addition to it at the end, because this is where the Christian context comes into the singing of the psalm. Glory to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. So the Christian as he sings the song, he sees Jesus Christ on it. The Old Testament worshiper saw the coming Messiah in it. We see the Christ who has already come, who is our leader, and as we worship, who is our supreme Lord, to whom we give our allegiance. Now, there is nothing wrong with reading the psalm this way, because we can, at this moment in history, see things in the psalm that couldn't be seen until we ourselves experienced Jesus Christ. The psalm itself presents then an ideal. Put it all together. The 110th psalm presents an ideal to the king. The king really never became all of this. The complete fulfillment of the king after the order of Melchizedek was never actually fulfilled in any Davidic king. The defeat of all of his enemies, Israel never defeated all their enemies. The promises made to these kings were never really fulfilled. That actually, in Jesus Christ and the hope of the church, we expect one day the fulfillment of this psalm to occur when all the enemies of the people of God are destroyed and the kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our Lord. It is then that this psalm reaches its final fulfillment. And as we sing it, we think of the promise made to the ancient king of Israel, fulfilled in the promises made to Jesus Christ, and ultimately fulfilled in the promises made to the church, the ultimate victory that is ours in Jesus Christ. This is the history of the use of this psalm. But two other psalms, of course, are important, and we must look at as we try to understand the thrust of the psalms for our time. Psalms 122 and 127 are both in the list of psalms known as the Pilgrim Psalms. I think the King James says accents or degrees. It says degrees, I believe. The Revised Standard Version says psalms of ascents. There are 15 of these, Psalm 120 through Psalm 134. And Psalm 120 through Psalm 134. Now, these psalms are now called Pilgrim Psalms because they apparently were used by pilgrims when they were coming to Jerusalem, either on the way or after they had come to the city. And many of these psalms were sung at stations along the way when the pilgrims were coming to Jerusalem on the annual pilgrimage. These pilgrim psalms are some of the most concise, some of the most artful works in the entire Psalter. The two psalms that are selected, Psalm 122 and 127, you can see why they are selected. Psalm 110 describes the leader of the people of God, the great king after the order of Melchizedek, the leader of the worshiping people. Psalm 122 describes how the worshiper feels about the house of worship. Here he is worshiping at the Vesper time, worshiping in the house of God. This is how he feels about this hour of worship. It describes his emotions and his feelings now that he is here. Psalm 122 is a psalm of praise. And it is the only one of these three psalms that has any sort of regular rhythm to it, a meter. Psalm 122 has a kina, 3-2 meter, almost all the way through it. Psalm 110 and Psalm 127, very irregular in meter. But Psalm 122 is very regular, very carefully worked out. It's a psalm of praise. It is interesting, though, it's not the kind of psalm of praise that you commonly run into, because usually the psalm of praise is a praise of Yahweh himself. But here is a psalm of praise, praising the sanctuary. There are a number of these psalms, but this is it's interesting to see that these ancient Hebrews believed that in praising the temple, praising Zion, praising the place of worship, they were praising God. Now we we're not inclined this way. We tend to distinguish between praise of God and praise of the church. You find that this hymn of praise is directed toward Zion, and being directed toward Zion, it was directed toward God. The worshiper in Psalm 122 is already in the temple. He has already arrived. He has already worshipped. He's now talking about his feelings. His feelings when he first started on this pilgrimage, but especially his feelings now that he has gone through the act of worship. It will describe both of his sentiments. He regards Zion as a sacred spot, and it is a sacred spot for two reasons. Because God has ordained it. It's very interesting to see his basis for this. It is a sacred spot because God has ordained it that it should be, and also because of its long heritage. That Israel has worshipped there through the centuries. God has decreed it, and it is there they have worshipped through the centuries. He says, I was glad when they said, let us go to the house of God. I was happy at the opportunity of going, looking forward to it. Couldn't wait to get there. This sort of bothers us, of course, because this is hardly the attitude which most of us approach our worship today, with anticipation and joy. Because, just as I said yesterday, our lament comes after we go. But to have any note of anticipation of something significant happening before we go to worship, this is not a thing common in our worship. We do not find it too often. Every once in a while, you'll be in a service, and you can tell by the whole atmosphere of the service that people are expecting something significant to happen, and it usually does. So it's very important to have a sense of anticipation, because without it, it's not likely anything will happen. We'll say more about that in a moment. But the psalm, starting out with this note of joy at the very idea of coming to the house of worship, closes with a blessing upon Jerusalem. It closes with a blessing upon the city of Jerusalem. This blessing is very important. Let's see how it reads in the translation. Peace, entreat me now for the peace for Jerusalem, and security for those who love thee. Pray for peace to be within you, and security within your towers. For love, for my friends and for my family, let there be peace for you. For the house of the Lord, my God, I have sought good things for you. So this prayer of blessing is a play on the word Jerusalem. The very name of Jerusalem, in the worshiper's mind, the very name of Jerusalem contains within itself an earnest of its peace. The very name of Jerusalem contains within itself an earnest of its peace, and he will make a play on this word Jerusalem. This word is so sacred, this word is so holy to him, that he can take the Salem part of it, which is the peace part of it, and can play on the word. He does this four times in this blessing. The word pray is associated with Salem, peace. The Hebrew word is shalu, S-H-A-A-L-U, shalu, shalom, peace, Salem, shalu, pray, the word pray, shalu, S-H-A-A-L-U. Then the word peace is in the passage, shalom, peace. The word translated prosper is from the same root, yish layu, Y-I-S-H-L-A-Y-U. Yish layu, which is the same root sound, and then the word tranquility, is Shalwah, which is again a play on the sound Shalom, Shalwah. So all through this prayer, he is taking the Salem peace side of that word and making a play on it, speaking to the peace and tranquility of the worshiping experience. Well, as we try to see then what this should mean to the worshiper today as he sings a psalm, I think several things will suggest themselves. Thinking about the thrust of this psalm as we sing it, and think about its meaning to us as worshipers. And of course the psalm has little meaning unless we ourselves can let it express how we feel about God. Well, the first thing this psalm does, it expresses a joy of worship. Now that's the way it starts out. That's its basic note. It's a wonderful thing to worship God. The joy of worship. It's a rewarding experience. The second thing it stresses is the unifying force of worship. How the people of God, the tribes, are all drawn together in this experience. The unifying force of worship. And people who are divided economically and socially and theologically can be unified in an act of worship. I can recall an experience I had along this line. Of course, I never could forget it. While I was pastor as a student in Trumbull County of Bedford, Kentucky, the Christian church was under repair, and they asked if they could come over to Baptist Church and worship with us. Of course, we were happy to have them come, and so they came over to our church. And you know, the Christian church, one of the differences between them and Baptists is that they have the communion every Sunday. And so when they came over to Baptist Church and sat down, their elders took the communion trays and started passing them to members of the Christian church right in the middle of our congregation. And I had a tizzy, of course, when I saw that was happening, and I stopped them. I said, wait just a minute. I said, what in the world are you doing? They said, well, you know, we take communion every Sunday, so we're passing out the communion to our members. Well, I said, we invited you here to our service because we wanted to unify ourselves in common Christian worship, and what you're doing is divisive and working against the very thing that we're trying to accomplish. I said, let me suggest that, I said, do you have enough of the elements to serve everybody? And they said, why, yes, we do. I said, well, let's just start over again. Of course, we Baptists do not think exactly the same thing that you do about the communion and about the church and about baptism. But we will all take this communion together. Well, we Baptists will take it in our way, and you can take it in your way, but we'll all take it together in a common worship of our Lord. And that's what we did, and it was one of the most wonderful experiences that I've ever had in worship. That worship can unify people, and they begin to realize that at the heart of their experience, they are worshiping the same God, and they are brothers. The unifying force of worship is outstanding in this psalm. A third thrust of the psalm is the fact that the peace of the state is bound up in the peace of the church. It is because of the presence of the temple at Jerusalem that this man prays for the peace of Jerusalem. It's because of the presence of the temple. And he knows that the peace of that city is tied up in an intimate way with the peace of the church. Now, this is something we need indeed to be reminded of in our time. Well, there are many people who think that the church can be destroyed and the nation prosper. But at the heart of the peace of the state is the peace of the church. And the welfare of the church is tied up in an intimate way with the welfare of the state. And you cannot isolate these two things and expect to have the welfare for all. And then the fourth thing, in the thrust of this psalm, is what we noted at the beginning, And that is that the psalmist is praising God when he praises the temple. When he praises the church, he is praising God. It is a psalm of praise to God, and yet he is praising the temple and the worship there. Now, we need to be reminded of this, because today is open season on the church. And we think out of one side of our mouth, we can attack the church. On the other side, from the other side of our mouth, we can praise God. But this can hardly be done. These two are tied up in a more intimate way than most of us realize. But immediately the person will reply, well, how can I praise the church? I don't see anything in it to praise. Now, that's a good answer. It reminds me of an experience I had last week. This pastor's wife was having some trouble with her little boy. He will not obey her. And he destroys everything in the neighborhood. I was talking with her about her problem, and suggested to her that that she needed to believe in this boy, and a lot of his meanness was due to the fact that he decided that she didn't have any confidence in him, and he wanted to prove that this lack of confidence was justified. And what she needed to do was to encourage him and to believe in him. Well, she said, I'm no hypocrite. She said, how can I believe in him? Said he's the meanest boy I've ever seen. Well, now, of course, now this is a problem that we have. How can we praise the church with all of its faults? How can we say anything good about it? How can we say anything good about worship that goes on in our churches? Baptists do not know how to worship, and how can you say any good thing about what we're doing? Well, you know, a strange thing happens. When you can say something good about people, about an experience, it begins to affect the person and the experience. And if you can just manage to say something good, even if it's reluctant, before long, the situation begins to change. When we nag and criticize, it always gets worse. When we can see something to praise, then it'll start getting better. The praise of the church is praise of God. Now Psalm 127. We have seen in Psalm 110 then concern for the leader of the people of God, talking about the great all-conquering king who would win out in history. And then we see the psalmist concerned about the place of worship. And now in Psalm 127, the psalmist is concerned about the worshipers themselves. The worshipers themselves. Not so much the king, not so much the place of worship, but now this psalm concentrates upon the people who are worshiping in the sanctuary. Except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. Now you can readily understand that many different arguments are going to be given about what that house is that is being built. Is it the temple? Mobenko, with his cultic emphasis, would insist it is a temple. The psalmist, I think, would allow you to substitute anything you want to allow. It's a temple? Yes. It's the individual house? Yes. It's your music program? Yes. It's the pastor's program in the church? Yes. It's whatever you're trying to build. He wouldn't care what you put in there. Except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. Doesn't make a difference what you're trying to build. Without the presence of God in this act, it is futile and doomed to failure. He wouldn't care what you did. Now, the original meaning might have to do with the dedication of a new sanctuary or something of this sort, or a renewal ceremony when the temple was rededicated to God. It might have been used this way. But the real sweep of this psalm goes beyond just the temple. It has to do with the individual worshiper. Notice he says three things here. And by the way, the type of psalm, yes, is a wisdom psalm. This is an unusual type. Not very common in the Psalter. a wisdom psalm that is more closely related to Proverbs than it is to the Psalter. And a good amount of this wisdom material is in the Psalms, but a psalm that to be classified as a wisdom psalm is very rare. In fact, the title on the psalm says it was written by Solomon. This is a later guess by later writers. There's very little chance that it is a Solomonic psalm. It has the reason why they said it was a Solomon psalm is because it has to do with the building of the house and building of a temple, Solomon, wisdom. You see, all of this would be tied together. But it is a wisdom psalm. And it's very irregular in its rhythm and in meter, but it sounds more like Proverbs than it does a psalm. That three things are emphasized in the psalm. First, the building of a house. Second, the watchman watching over the city. And third, a man's hard labor. The building of a house, a watchman watching over the city, and a man toiling in his labor. Well, these are the three emphases in the Psalms. And it is said that without God, all of these activities are vain. If you're building a house without God, it will fall. If you're trying to protect your city without God, the city will be invaded. The watchman watches in vain. You can work yourself to death without God, and your labor be futile. Now, whatever it is that you're doing without God is nothing but futility. Now, the psalmist doesn't mean by this that you're not supposed to try to build a house. He doesn't mean by this you're not supposed to have a watchman on the wall. He doesn't mean by this you're not supposed to toil. But he means to do this without God is futile. Now the psalmist does a strange thing to us. He describes what it is that God does for a man. Now, if a man really tries to build a house and he looks to God for further help, if he puts up the watchman but depends upon God to be the ultimate protection of the city, if he works hard and expects God to give some meaning to his toil, then what will God do for him? Well, two things. Two things he will do for this man who trusts in him. He will give him sleep, and he will give him children. He will give him sleep, and he will give him children. Now, you and I, you know, we're so idealistic, we would never get on this kind of thing. It's too practical. we'd like to get off into the clouds somewhere on what God does for a man, but... actually, when you think about it, this is sound theology. Today, in particular, to be able to sleep, this in itself is quite an achievement. To find time for it while you're studying in seminars, particularly in music school, would be worthwhile. I know some of you sleep in class and make up for it that way. For years, I taught a class from the music school, and I still teach it every once in a while, music school students. I taught the first one when the music school was just beginning. I had the original students of the seminary. We had a class for them. Met over across the road in the home that's now Dr. McCall's home. I'll never forget that year. The year in which our first child was born, and the girls gave him a silver spoon. We had a great time. They were all girls in that class. But one of these music school classes I had, in all the classes they used to go to sleep. But I found it a reason for it was that they've been working so hard. I've often said that if our preacher would practice and work on their sermons the way you musicians work on your music, that we would have saved the world by now. But the reason for it is, not you take too much credit for it, the reason for it is that when you make a mistake, you can't cover up. You do the same thing. You get by with it, but you can't get by with it. But the preacher can talk his way out of most of the trouble he gets in doing it. Therefore, he doesn't strive for perfection, but he'd do well to do it, I would say. In this music school class that I had always students sleeping. But I had one class on which the girl snored, and I really objected to this. Every morning she would wake up all the other students with her snore. That class always met at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that had some problems. Well, in a way, he's very practical. He says, sleep, I'll give you sleep, and I'll give you children. Now, well, of course, now, we might think in more idealistic terms, like Isaiah will. In the second part of Isaiah will deal with this whole problem in a more ideal way. He will talk about the eunuchs who can't have any children, who are worshiping God. They can't have any children. And how will God reward them, these who worship God in his temple? And Isaiah will say in chapter 56, verse 4, he will say, I will give you a name and a memorial in my house that is worth more than children. Or you'll find Isaiah also talking about the descendants and the children of the servant, who are not just his physical children, but who believe in what he has done and are given themselves to the same sacrificial task to which the servant has committed himself. And it'll be more in the realm of the ideal. But here is the practical side of it, which is, I think, very significant. But he will say to us in its basic thrust, say to us in our time, as we worship with a psalm, and as we use it to express how we feel about our God and about our worship, it speaks of the vanity of a man trying to live his life without God. That if you want to have anything that's permanent, and of course that's what we all want, and all of us want some kind of immortality, but most of us would feel like the writer of the 90th Psalm feels about it, where he says, the work of our hands, O Lord, establish therein. If you want to establish a work that is permanent and lasting and will go beyond the time in which you live, then work with God, because he is the one that gives permanence to your work. And he talks about it, the psalmist talks about it in terms of your children who carry on when you're so weak and infirm that you can't defend yourself, that they'll defend you. What we would think about in the final thrust of this is that a man, if he wants to build his life and work on something that's lasting, let his work be a part of the eternal work of God. And then what you do will never be futile. And even though somebody else may have to carry it on after you are gone, you will have had a significant part in what is yet to be.